From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. President Obama proposes the America's College Promise program, which would cover the cost of tuition for students in community colleges. And a new book by two former college presidents addresses the challenges that confront academic governance. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these discussions on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. We begin our program today talking about America's College Promise, a free community college education for all. President Obama traveled to Tennessee late last week to announce an ambitious new federal initiative that would cover the full cost of tuition at community colleges for all students. Modeled in part on a plan promoted by Tennessee Republican Governor Bill Haslam, the Obama program, called America's College Promise, would provide $60 billion over a decade to fill the tuition gaps for community college students that are not covered by Pell Grants and other financial aid programs. The feds would cover 75% of the cost, and the individual states would fund the balance. Students would have to maintain a 2.5 GPA and also make steady progress towards the completion of either a two-year vocational program or general education credits needed to transfer to a four-year college. America's College Promise echoes the recommendations of the 1947 Truman Commission on Higher Education, which first proposed free community college tuition, and also the 1960 California Master Plan, which launched free tuition across the state's two-year institutions. But the proposal has already confronts congressional opposition on cost, policy, and programmatic issues. Critics comment that many students who don't need additional financial assistance will nonetheless benefit. And they also ask about clear incentives or requirements to improve the quality of academic and vocational programs. Two, senior officials at some public four-year institutions express concern that free tuition at community colleges would affect lower division enrollments at their campuses. Joining us for this conversation are Robert Kelchin, an assistant professor of higher education at Seton Hall University. Gail Mello is the president of LaGuardia Community College, and Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So let's begin with the College Promise proposal. In one sense, we have been here before. California's community colleges were tuition-free for several decades, assuming congressional approval, and admittedly that's a big if at this point. What does the California experience, plus the new initiatives in Tennessee and Chicago and elsewhere, suggest about the goals for and the implementation challenges that confront America's College Promise? Gail Mello at LaGuardia Community College, what's ahead for this proposal?
Well, I think this is absolutely a landing on the moon, GI Bill, amazing and important proposal. It really changes the conversation about what do we need in a knowledge economy as the base level of education. And just as when we changed from fifth grade or sixth grade to high school a long time ago, I think this really reframes what we need as a country in the modern era to really get the kind of people who can be the citizens and the employees that we want. So I think it's pretty extraordinary.
And Robert Kelchin, you've written about some of the challenges and some of the benefits of community colleges being tuition-free. What's ahead for this proposal?
At the federal level, this won't be adopted anytime in the next few years. It's pretty clear at this point the Republicans want no part of this at the federal level, even if they like it at the state level. But what this does do is it starts an important conversation about whether community college should be tuition-free, and it also may encourage some states to take on making their state community colleges tuition-free.
And Scott Jasek, you're watching this from a news perspective. What's ahead over the next 2 years, the closing 2 years of the Obama administration?
I agree that what has really happened is that the conversation has changed. I mean, think about the people who hate this idea are talking about how much they love Pell Grants and that Pell Grants would be better. Now, not to take a stand one way or another on that, but the reality is these are people who haven't previously been showing such love for Pell Grants or for any federal spending. There was something big and bold enough here that it captured the public view. You know, we here at Inside Higher Ed, we would care about any proposal about community colleges. But this is on page one of newspapers all over the country. Average people are talking about it. And I think that's really significant regardless of what Congress does.
Gail Mello, the ASAP program at CUNY, Accelerated Study and Associate Program, seems to be one of the several community college programs that provide part of a model for America's College Promise. How does ASAP work, and, you know, also, does it work?
It does work, and I think it demonstrates absolutely that investment in community colleges works. One of the things that's real about the ASAP program is that it costs about $4,000 additional dollars per year per student. And what that allows us to do is give much tighter advising to students, bring them through in cohorts, give them, in New York City, Metro cards, so give them transportation and free tuition and books. And it is those social supports plus a cohort model of education that is 20-30% more effective than allowing comparable students who don't have those kinds of academic supports. So it's been very productive. It's expensive up front. You really gain when you look at the graduation rates.
But there's lots of evidence that, that cohort models and support really do make a difference for commuter students, whether they're in four-year regional institutions that are in metropolitan areas or in community colleges. The Obama proposal doesn't necessarily address that. Robert Kelchin?
Yeah, the community college proposal is more feasible from a cost perspective, because if it's only $4,000 per student per year, in theory, federal spending may be able to cover a good chunk of that, but you still leave individual institutions or private donations to cover that gap. And is this something that can scale up to cover a large number of institutions and a large number of students who may not be able to go full-time? That remains to be seen, although the ASAP intervention does appear to be promising.
So let's talk about who benefits from this program. There's already been criticism that free tuition really provides more benefits for middle and upper income students than it does for low income students. Is this a useful critique, given that low tuition policies at public institutions in many states have always provided benefits to middle and upper income students? Scott, let me begin with you about the public critique.
Sure. Well, I would, you know, forget tuition policy alone. Look at the HOPE program in Georgia and many other state programs. Our country has actually embraced the idea of full tuition or close to it for students who may not need any aid. But we've done so for those attending flagship universities. Now, you can debate the pros and cons of that, but most states have actually embraced that idea. Where they haven't embraced the idea is for those who go to community colleges.
And Gail, the counterpoint as an advocate for community colleges, as the president of a community college, in terms of, you know, will this provide disproportionate benefits to middle and upper income students?
Politically, we understand, I think, in America that to make things go, we really have to impact a large swath of people. What's critical here is if you bring more money to the community colleges, the impact is huge because of the percentage of the students in undergraduate education who are at community colleges. We're talking about 60%. So really infusing more money in that makes an enormous difference. And I would point out, even with sort of a doubling of the amount of money coming to community colleges, which is my estimate of what might happen, we're still about, the rate of spending per student when you look at 4-year versus 2-year is about 3-1. So we're still a little bit behind the ball, but it would be an extraordinarily important initiative.
And Robert Kelchin, months before the Obama initiative announcement last fall, you wrote an opinion piece at Inside Higher Ed suggesting rather than focusing on tuition, there would be some other ways to do more targeted spending that might have greater benefits.
Yes, and what I'd written about were the programs in Tennessee and in Chicago where they were functioning as last-dollar scholarships. And what that means is the state or the city kicks in money after the federal government puts in the Pell Grant. So the way those Tennessee and Chicago programs work, if a student has the greatest financial need in a maximum Pell Grant, they don't get any money from the state or from the city. Apparently, the federal program will work differently, but we don't know how much money low-income students will get in addition to what they currently get. But going back to the benefits to upper-income students, there aren't a lot of upper-income students attending community college at this point. Most of the benefits would go to middle-income families. And is that something that is okay? That's really a political question, but it's something that will play out during the conversation.
It seems that with this proposal, the devil is in the details. Similarly, for example, with the federal ratings proposal that was announced in December, that we're awaiting a lot of the specificity about how this will play out. Let's talk about some of these issues. Clearly, community colleges serve a large population of students who require remedial work. Given the requirement, at least in the initial announcement, that eligible students will make steady progress towards transfer credits or a vocational certificate, will students in remedial programs be eligible for this initiative? What are some of the other implementation details that are still pending? Gail Mello, what are you looking to hear?
Well, I think you've identified the huge one. We really have to understand, does remediation count as progress towards degree? But I also think that where there's talk about using evidence-based practices, that could be an enormous boost to community colleges. I've been working, for example, with the Carnegie Foundation on their StatWay QuantWay program, where we see sevenfold increases in the number of students who get through a college-level math course when you link it to statistics as opposed to pre-calculus. And that's a great program for students who are going into lots of areas of healthcare and communications and other places. So I think one of the other devils in the detail is, what are those evidentiary-based practices that the federal government would like to see us use? And I think there are some very promising ones that I would welcome.
Robert Kelchin, what details are you looking for as this program unfolds?
Going on the evidence base a little bit, I'd like to see colleges have some flexibility to try new things, and as long as they evaluate them rigorously, have that count, at least in the short term, as evidence-based. But the biggest details that I'm still waiting for involves the state-federal partnership. What exactly does it mean for the federal government to cover three-fourths of the cost? Does that effectively punish colleges that are in low tuition states? And what happens when local communities and counties fund community colleges instead of the states? Those are all really important details that we just don't know yet.
And Scott, this partnership between the feds and the states, with the feds assuming 75% and states 25%, this is a little bit like Obamacare. There seems to be an option for states to participate. That's going to also play out in some very interesting ways, won't it?
Certainly. Well, but again, I would put the question to many of the critics. A lot of the Republicans are saying, oh, the states should do this, the states should do this. Well, let the states do it. The reality is one has, but there's a lot of room for others. There's also the question, though, even through this federal program, should it exist, how do the states handle issues like capacity? There are states where if community college enrollment increased by 10, 20%, they have the capacity now. But part of the cost to the state is making sure that there are enough faculty members, particularly in high demand fields, of enough labs and so forth, so that they could admit students. My guess, and Gail, you'll have to fill me in on this, is at a place like LaGuardia, there are probably programs where there are talented students, but there's no room. So part of the state or the local contribution needs to be, well, this is great. Let's say we get these students. How do we educate them?
And it would I'm sorry, Gail, please, go ahead.
I was just going to respond to Scott. I was going to say that that's true, but it's also this where this kind of conversation is very exciting, because imagine in a high-demand field, so let's say I want to do database cybersecurity, that if I partnered with 12 different businesses and I had the money to support students in that, then it really might produce a whole wealth of new kinds of connections that would provide spaces for students, and also I would rope in some great new faculty, adjunct faculty who are in the field. So it opens up opportunities.
But it also, it would seem, open up some risk for the states. There's an interesting blog post at Inside Higher Ed today from a community college dean about the cycle of enrollments and how the economy and enrollments in community colleges sort of ebb and flow. The economy is down, community college enrollments go up, but that's also when state budgets are down. I mean, it's easy potentially for many states to commit to this during flush times, but when the rush in enrollments would come during a down economic cycle, that's typically when states cut budgets to community colleges as opposed to increase those budgets. Gail, I mean, think about the situation in New York and just the experience that the state of New York and other states have had coming out of the Great Recession that began in 2008.
It's true, but one of the ideas that I have seen floated again in the blogosphere is really including maintenance of effort clause in the kind of relationships that the state and the federal government had, which could moderate some of that fluctuation.
Scott, is that viable? I mean, given that states can't run deficits and the feds can, the feds can borrow money to sustain this program. The state of New York or California or New Jersey or Missouri can't, or Tennessee for that matter, can't. And again, for the next down economic cycle, which is not a matter of if but when, hopefully not for a long time, if this program launches, which is still a matter of debate and political process, many states could find themselves making initial commitments that they can't fulfill.
That's certainly a risk, but I would again turn to the Hope Scholarships as an example. Those became so politically popular that when states hit bad economic times, many those programs were protected. In some cases, people criticized them for being protected too much because of they helped so many middle and upper middle class and wealthy students. Programs that work and that build a political base can be protected. If you take Gail's example with cybersecurity, if she were to do that, you can bet that those industry leaders would care about preserving that program.
What about the issue of the equilibrium of enrollment scale? I mean, there are some observers who suggest that at some institutions, free community college tuition would essentially draw away a significant part of their lower division undergraduate population.
Well, if that were true, then our tuition might have already done that. I sort of feel that's a straw dog. Community colleges tend to serve a very different kind of population, and I don't think Seton Hall has anything to worry about Middlesex Community College. They're sort of different and interestingly different kinds of populations who go to different colleges. There might be a little bit of that on the margin, but I don't see a wholesale change there.
Yeah, but Robert Kelchin, it is true that during the downturn, people buy down. Families that would have gone to a residential institution, think local commuter, some that might have gone to the local four-year metropolitan institution might have, if you will, bought down to the community college. Does this provide incentives to continue the buy down beyond the recession?
It provides possible incentives for students to go to less expensive institutions. And this is where watching Tennessee, I think, is really important. Will students be induced to go to community college in Tennessee when it's potentially several thousand dollars a year less expensive now? And this is something that we can learn from the states as we think about this policy going forward at the federal level in the years or even decades to come.
Scott, your take about the enrollment equilibrium issues that this might create?
I actually think we should look more at what might happen 2 years after these students enroll. Assuming the program happens, we're already seeing much more interest at four-year institutions, including private and some elite institutions, in community college transfer students. I think many of these institutions realize that many families right now will never pay 4 years of private college tuition, and so you see more work on articulation agreements, on sending academic advisors from a four-year private or public into a community college to work with pre-transfers. While there might be some loss at some four-year institutions of freshmen, it's also possible that they could gain new transfer students, which may become a more important population.
And may I add to that? The other piece is, what will those students look like? And the other power of that, which I think is a brilliant idea, as Scott is so often brilliant, is to really understand that most black and brown students, most low socioeconomic students are going to community colleges no matter what. Imagine the power of an American, of a future America, where those students then continue to public and private colleges, and therefore those students from community colleges massively diversify the people who are getting a bachelor's degree today.
Let's talk about the cup to lip issue, sort of going from proposal to policy. President Obama acknowledged in a press conference not long ago he is in the fourth quarter of his administration. This is one of several very bold policy initiatives, policy pronouncements. What's the real likelihood that this proposal, America's College Promise, as separate legislation or as part of the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, becomes law of the land by the end of the Obama administration in 2016? Gail, will they make it?
Well, of course, I don't really know the answer to that question, but what I will say is that it's very interesting to look at how the Republican response to this. And I think what we see if you line up Republican and Democrat governors, senators, legislatures, is that everyone understands that we need to do a better job in America to get people ready to live in our society, and in particular, to be productive in that society. That's a bipartisan issue, and I think there is a surprising amount, you know, look at Tennessee as an example, of Republican governors who understand that unless they can invest effectively in higher education for a much bigger swath of their populace, that they're not going to survive as well as a state, and nor are we as a country. So I'm more optimistic about the potential bipartisan play of this idea.
Robert Kelchin, you made a fairly strong statement that this, when we began this conversation, that this just ain't going to happen.
At the federal level, this will not happen in the next 2 years. Even putting the merits of the plan aside, the federal government and Congress want to look at getting the Elementary and Secondary Education Act reauthorized and get the Higher Education Act reauthorized before really taking up any other big issues. But I think there's a lot of pressure on the GOP side just to let states go ahead and work on this first. And if it works out in states, then maybe consider a version of this at the national level.
So, Scott, is this just a gauntlet thrown at the feet of both Congress and governors to do something or do something more, do something significant, do something dramatic about community colleges with the understanding that, you know, there's little chance that it will actually make it to policy at the federal level?
You know, I wouldn't bet on this happen, on this plan being adopted, but I have to say, after the midterm elections, I was of the view that nothing would happen and that Obama wouldn't be able to get any ideas through Congress. And now I am thinking maybe something just might. He's managed to identify an issue that speaks to every state. He's managed to do it by showering praise on a Republican. It would, you know, the odds are against it, but if the stars align such that Republicans want to find an education initiative on which they can move forward with the president, they might just go for one that involves saying it was a Republican governor's idea.
Great. Gail Mello and Robert Kelchin, thank you for joining us. Scott Jasik as well, for a very engaging conversation about the community college initiative from the Obama administration. In our second segment today, we'll talk about a new model for academic governance. Locus of Authority, a new book by two former college presidents, seeks to find a new middle ground and offer pragmatic guidelines for academic governance and campus management. The authors, William Bowen and Eugene Tobin, begin by asking if, quote, it is reasonable to expect a century-old structure of faculty governance to enable colleges and universities of all kinds to respond to the new demands for far more cost-effective student learning, end quote. Drawing on their collective experience, new research, and extensive case studies at several institutions, the authors argue for a new model of governance which engages faculty and administrators, is grounded in a shared vision of mission, builds or rebuilds trust, yet also at times seems to assign primacy on some key issues to administrators. Joining us for this conversation are William G. Bowen, who is the President Emeritus of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and also President Emeritus of Princeton University. Eugene Tobin is a senior program officer at the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and a past president of Hamilton College. And Scott Jasik is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to you all. William Bowen and Eugene Tobin, as we begin this conversation, I'm reminded of the story of President Eisenhower during his short tenure as president of Columbia University. The story goes that shortly before his investiture, he's talking with the provost about an issue where faculty and administration are divided. Eisenhower, who went to West Point and lived his professional life in military organizations marked by command and control, says to the provost, "Why doesn't the university simply tell the faculty what to do?" To which the provost responds without missing a beat, "Generally, you have to understand, faculty are the university." So in that context, why this book and why this topic and why now for locus of authority? William Bowen?
The reason the book is important is that American higher education is simply not getting its job done. Completion rates are too low, time to degree is too long, costs are rising faster than most people can pay them. And in order to address those issues, decision-making needs to be changed in some ways.
And Eugene Tobin, this really seems in part, though it's governance, based on William Bowen's comment a moment ago, this seems to be also about leadership.
It is leadership, and leadership that represents aspects of what faculty do, presidents, provosts, boards of trustees, and regents. But it's also a societal issue, largely for the reasons Bill mentioned, the fact that there's a national commitment right now to educate more people at reasonable cost. This is not lofty political rhetoric, but a very practical objective in order to have the country remain competitive in the world.
So I want to begin with the question that you both ask at the beginning of the book, which is, quote, if institutions that educate growing numbers of students from first-generation, underrepresented, and disadvantaged backgrounds are able to make organizational and pedagogical changes that can preserve higher education as an engine of social progress, and can those institutions, regarded as pacesetters in both the public and private sectors, do more than maintain their positions in the higher education hierarchy? This sounds like it's unique to this situation, but doesn't that characterize higher education since the end of the Second World War, a rising tide of first-generation students and new challenges? William Bowen?
No, the situation is different today. It's different today because of much greater concern about rising costs and affordability, and also because technology now offers us new opportunities to address fundamental issues of productivity that are really at the core, or should be at the core, of this discussion.
Scott, Jessic, you've been watching this. I mean, how big of an issue is academic governance in terms of the reporting that you do with Inside Higher Ed?
It's huge, and the reality is, as we just heard, it is a different era right now. So you see campus after campus where a president will say, we need to do initiative such and such that involves online education, and we're going to change the way we do business in certain ways. And in many cases, this seems imposed on faculty, or that's how they perceive it. Then you hear presidents in turn say, oh, well, the faculty are afraid of change or are Luddites or whatever they will say to criticize faculty. And then you throw in tight budgets. Many institutions are looking at these shifts not just to serve new students, but because their budgets have disappeared. So you have a bunch of things going on at the same time, and we have story after story about faculty saying they're being ignored, administrators saying the faculty won't get engaged.
Eugene Tobin, are faculty afraid of change, or are they looking for a compelling reason to change? I mean, certainly that's some of the conversation we hear about technology on campuses these days.
I think some of the most innovative work we've seen with respect to the use of technology has come from the faculty. So I think there is a coterie of faculty across the country who are very interested in imagining how they would use different teaching pedagogies to enhance their students' experiences. But there also needs to be a recognition on the part of both faculty and administrators that talking about cost and quality is not sacrilegious or mutually excludable.
You know, there's a point early in the book where you talk about the right to be heard versus the right to prevail. Bill Bowen, would you talk a little bit more about that? Can you expand that for us a bit?
Well, the right to be heard is extremely important, and administrators who are ultimately accountable have to take full advantage of the insights and the enthusiasms of faculty. This cannot be an either-or matter. What is needed is more collegiality, more trust, more talking across differences.
And you talk about in the book as well about horizontal thinking, which we go beyond departmental perspectives and disciplinary silos in an effort to address major institutional challenges, such as the ones that you've mentioned in the past few moments, operating costs, pedagogical strategies, the deployment of technology, and completion rates. But given the current structure and culture of academia, what can the two of you offer in terms of strategies that will help campuses move towards this? Eugene Tobin, let me drop that one on you. What are the two or three things that would lead a campus towards this transition towards horizontal thinking?
Now, one of the recurring themes we try to emphasize throughout the book is the importance of encouraging faculty and administrators to be in the same setting talking about college, campus-wide, and system-wide concerns so that the faculty in particular get a much better appreciation for the macroeconomic issues that are affecting the institution or the system. At the same time, administrators have to appreciate the faculty's, I think, appropriately territorial sense of responsibility for the delivery of instruction. The fact that they see each other too often as being in divided sectors strikes us as being an anomaly and something that speaks directly in opposition to the notion of a shared governance operation, which would enhance teaching and learning across the country.
Scott Jasek, can you imagine campuses going horizontal in their thinking along the lines being suggested by the Locus of Authority book?
I can certainly imagine it. I think a lot of it has to do with who's on that campus and who's leading that campus, both as president and on the faculty. If you look at the places where this doesn't work, where everyone just ends up protecting their turf, a lot of the times I have seen it where a proposal is made primarily to save money. We're going to reorganize, we're going to use online, we're going to do this, that, and the other, with the goal of cutting X amount. Now, good online instruction may well have efficiencies, but it's not cheap. And so faculty get very suspicious when programs start that way. They also get very suspicious, from my reporting, when there seems to be a predetermined conclusion. We are going to do X, as opposed to, let's have a discussion about how to better serve a new group of students or our current students. So some of this does have to do with just how people talk to one another, how issues are framed, so that people don't dig in their heels.
So let's take one specific example of the we're going to do X that Scott alluded to. Bill Bowen, in this book with Eugene Tobin and in your last book, Higher Education in the Digital Age, there's a clear message about the rising role and increasing importance of technology and instruction. And in this book, you write together, quote, "It's time for individual faculty to give up, cheerfully and not grudgingly, any claim to sole authority over teaching methods of all kinds," end quote. Why is this a governance issue, and why should administrators have more authority over pedagogy, and particularly the use of technology and resources and instruction and the movement to online ed, than faculty? Bill Bowen?
I wouldn't phrase the question in such either-or terms. I think what is different today is that technology imposes decisions that cut across departmental lines, decisions having to do with large investments of money and also with where the benefits of economies are to go. And you can't just look at these questions in a silo-like fashion or in a department-centered fashion. You need conversation across departmental lines and even across institutional lines. That's one of the things that technology gives us. May I give you an example of how I think the shared governance concepts that we articulate can actually work?
Please.
At Princeton, in the troubled times of the late 60s and early 70s, some of us invented something called the Priorities Committee. The Priorities Committee is a group that consists of both administrators, chaired by the provost, and elected faculty members and some other people. And this group of people was locked in a room and told that they couldn't come out until they agreed on a set of recommendations that balance, that deal with trade-offs between academic values and the need to balance budgets. And the system, which is described in the case study in the back of the book, has worked extraordinarily well over the years. And I think it's an actual example of cutting across boundaries to reach consensus on important trade-offs.
But Princeton, many would argue, is a unique institution. Eugene Tobin, and you were at a smaller institution at Hamilton. You have both traveled to other institutions. Does that kind of lock them up until they reach a decision strategy viable for many other campuses, Gene Tobin?
I don't think there's anything about the Princeton example that can't be replicated in institutions of various sizes across the country. One of the points we try to make throughout the book is that governance has never been a static concept. It's changed constantly in response to new needs and circumstances. And in talking about the uses and advances that technology provides, we know that faculty and administrators realize that hybrid blended learning that combines the use of technology and face-to-face instruction is absolutely essential at almost every institution that I can think of. The problem that we have had, which is one that you've identified earlier, is encouraging faculty and administrators to sit down and to talk through the faculty's concern about the ownership of intellectual property as well as the nature of the curriculum and the administration's willingness to share in as transparent a fashion as possible all of the concerns about the importance of introducing cost efficiencies that don't come at the expense of quality.
Scott, can you imagine being outside the door as a journalist waiting for these groups to emerge from the kind of lock them up and come out with a decision?
Well, I actually think it has greater chance of working if it's not a one-time lock them up in a room situation, but an ongoing conversation. I think one of the problems with many of these conversations on some campuses to date is it only takes place at a point of crisis. And I think you have to educate people on both sides over a period of time. We ran a blog post this week by one of our bloggers who's a community college vice president about a tradition they have of data day at his campus where the administrators share the data that they're looking at to make decisions. And faculty can say, well, we'd like to learn more about the graduation rate data or our appropriations data or whatever. That's the kind of thing that has to take place, I would say, regularly to have the sort of spirit that that this book calls for, so that people are have the information to make informed suggestions.
Let's turn to the recent National Labor Board ruling. In December, the National Labor Board acknowledged the limited role of faculty as managers in campus decision-making at many institutions, and that's likely going to energize efforts towards faculty unions at many colleges, particularly private colleges and universities. Gentlemen, what's your view of the NLRB decision? How does it affect the movement to this new model of governance that you propose? Eugene Tobin?
I think we'll have to wait and see, quite frankly. Anything that encourages faculty and administrators to sit down and to talk through issues rather than to have a checklist of what's yours and what's mine would be something I think that both Bill and I would support. But if the NLRB ruling further accentuates a sense of division or separateness between the faculty and the administration and board, that I think is troublesome. There's no question in looking back at even the origins of the AAUP back in the early 20th century that it went a long way toward preserving some absolutely unassailable rights, such as academic freedom. Now we're in a very different era. We have both seen excellent examples of agreements where collective bargaining is the basis for it, but we've also seen wonderful examples of faculty and administrators working together without union activity. So I'm not sure that the structure itself or the decision will enhance our advocacy of the kind of shared governance that we advocate.
Scott Jasek, last week on This Week at Inside Higher Ed, we focused on the NLRB ruling, and we talked about what it says in the context of campuses that do or don't engage in shared governance, or presidents who say, we're benevolent and we do. Let's revisit a little bit of that conversation, if you would, please.
Sure. I mean, I actually think the timing of this book and the NLRB decision together are really interesting, because I have so far heard from private college presidents only who are dismayed by the decision and don't want to see collective bargaining on their campuses. And from a legal perspective, there's the, can they show that there is enough of a meaningful role? But there's also the question, I mean, the book is sort of proposing a grand compromise of sorts. And if college presidents and faculty did that, the faculties might choose not to unionize. And so right now, I think we're going to see much more of a discussion on many campuses on what is a meaningful faculty role. Do the current structures work to give faculty a meaningful role? And faculty have just gained some leverage in that they could now call the you know, AFT or AAUP and NEA and say, come in and organize us. Most presidents don't want to see that happen.
Bill Bowen, for the presidents and the aspiring presidents who read Locus of Authority, what are the three things they can do and they must do if they move towards this model of governance that you and Eugene Tobin propose?
Before I answer your question, I need to correct a serious misperception that occurred in our conversation a little while ago. The Priorities Committee process and other efforts to get people to talk together are not one-time, once-a-year things. The Priority Committee meets throughout the year, and I think the ongoing nature of these collaborative conversations and participatory efforts to reach decisions are really important. It's not a one-time thing. The second misperception that I would note is that we haven't said enough about leadership. And one of the things that our book does is involve a conversation with Clark Kerr over many, many years. And I think he was right when he said we need to stop denigrating leadership. And he said many other things that we really need to take into account today. Sorry, but I just needed to clear up those points.
Fair points. And again, for the presidents and aspiring presidents who will read your book, what are the three things they can or must do to move towards this model that you and Eugene Tobin are proposing?
Well, first of all, they must participate in an understanding of the importance of costs. One of the points we make in the book is that there is such an aversion to talking about costs, either by faculty or by administrators. As Kerr once said, talking about costs is the new evil in higher education. Well, it isn't an evil. It's essential. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to treat faculty with real respect and to find ways, as in the Priorities Committee model, to engage them actively and effectively in leadership. And the third thing is to be clear about accountability. When administrators, deans, presidents don't do well, they need to go. And accountability is a really important aspect of all of this, which is sometimes neglected.
And Eugene Tobin, on the flip side of that, three things that faculty leaders who clearly care about their institutions and acknowledge a changing terrain must do for their part to reach this vision that you and Bill Bowen are proposing.
You know, the flip side, of course, would be that faculty, I think, have to enter into their conversations at the department, division, and university-wide levels with a great deal of respect for the responsibilities that administrators are asked to play. And most faculty members that I've worked with over the decades have great respect, you know, for the system-wide concerns. But I do think that faculty members who are in leadership positions have to encourage their colleagues across the campuses to be much more well-informed about the macroeconomic issues affecting higher education. You know, one of the points that Kerr makes, you know, in the 1963 Godkin lectures that are still very much with us today, is understanding that faculty and administrators are in a shared endeavor, and that endeavor will only work if they're willing to be equally transparent with each other. So one of the things that I would suggest, and I know that Bill noted, is full transparency on the part of both faculty leaders and college and university presidents about what the concerns are, so that there's no question that anything is being hidden behind the wall that is, you know, not available to faculty or to administrators from the faculty's perception. Secondly, I think that faculty members who have access to information about those macroeconomic issues should understand how those issues affect them on the campus in terms of the curriculum, staffing, hiring, tenure positions, numbers of contingent faculty.
Great. Gentlemen, thank you. Bill Bowen and Gene Tobin, thank you for your time this morning for the conversation about academic governance in your new book, Locus of Authority. Our thanks as well to Gail Mello from LaGuardia Community College and Robert Kelchin from Seton Hall University for the conversation about the Obama administration's Community College Initiative. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or a podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. And This Week is also available on iTunes. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.